Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, April 10th, 2007 Carrboro Board of Aldermen work session. A couple of our members of the Board of Aldermen have professional obligations that are going to keep them a little bit late at work, but they will be joining us in about half an hour. And I know that some of the members of the board who are not able to be here tonight were particularly interested in our first agenda item. However, unless it's the board's pleasure to do otherwise, the folks from Owosso are here to speak to us and have other engagements later this evening. So I think we'll just proceed with our regularly scheduled agenda, if that's acceptable to the board.
Please.
What can you do? All right. With that, we begin our agenda with an explanation of or discussion of Owosso's plans to increase connection fees for new customers for water and sewer services. We are graced tonight with the presence of the chairman of the Owosso board, Mr. Mac Clark. You are still the chairman, right?
I'm still the chairman as we speak.
He's still the chairman as we speak. More senior member of the Owosso board, William Stott, has a professional obligation at the coast that precludes his being here tonight. So he sent his respectful regrets about not being here. Mac.
Thank you, Mark. Good evening, Mr. Mayor. Good evening, members of the board. I'm going to be very brief, and then I'm going to hand over to Mr. Kevin Ray, who is our finance director, who will give you a brief presentation just to highlight the salient matters. But I hope that my letter to you of April 4th did anticipate and perhaps answer most of the questions. However, at the end of Kevin's presentation, we will, of course, be very happy to answer any questions and to listen to whatever comments and discussion you may wish to enter into. Thank you. Kevin?
Good evening. As Mr. Clark said, my presentation will be rather brief, but I wanted to highlight the points that we've already made in the written documentation and written response to you, hopefully be able to add some additional illumination there. And, of course, as Mr. Clark said, we would stand ready to answer any questions you may have in addition to that. But it strikes me that before we can answer or should answer the question about why such or why the level of increase in the proposed service availability fees, that we go back and revisit briefly just what those availability fees are, what they represent. And in a nutshell, our water and sewer service availability fees are a one-time only charge, generally to new customers, to recover a fair share, equitable cost or a proportion of the cost of our infrastructure development as it relates to capacity development. In other words, our backbone facilities. This one-time charge in aggregate represents about 8% of Owosso's overall revenue stream annually. It is, but the important point here is that it's a one-time fee basically charged to a new customer for their fair share of the capacity that exists or that we will develop in the near future in order to accommodate their new connection. The backbone facilities I referred to are major components of the water and sewer infrastructure. For the water utility, it includes the water supply and transmission mains, water treatment, pumping, storage, and distribution facilities. On the wastewater side, it's the collection mains, also the wastewater pumping, treatment, and biosolids disposal facilities. It does not include some of the minor distribution lines and does not include those major components that are built by developers and then dedicated to Owosso. Those are excluded from the definition of the backbone facilities. The approach to calculating this fair share buy-in fee based on cost of service principles. And the methodology that we use there is an analysis, again, using cost of service, that takes a look at our total cost of infrastructure development in those backbone facilities, less depreciation. That's an important point. As a new customer comes on board, you would not expect that customer to pay new car price for a used car, and so depreciation is excluded from this calculation of the fee because you wouldn't expect them to pay the original cost on a used facility either. We also use the cost of service analysis of the total cost per unit of capacity within the system. And then all of that is put into terms of the expected demand created by that new connection, that new customer. Put it in its simplest terms, mathematical terms, the bottom two bullets are the basic calculation that goes into the determination of these fees. You take those backbone facilities, or the dollar value of them, once again, less depreciation, and you divide that by the system capacity measured in gallons, and that will yield a dollar value per gallon of capacity. Then you take that dollar value per gallon of capacity and multiply it by the assumed customer demand for the new measured in gallons for that new connection. In a nutshell, it's that simple. Where it becomes more complicated are the assumptions and the information that goes into that formula. This year, we've adopted one of several methods for calculating the service availability fees. This year, we've adopted the one called total plant in service calculation method. This is a little different than what's been employed in the past, and it's a relatively new, although over the last decade or a little longer, it's been growing significantly in acceptance throughout the industry. But it's an improvement over previous calculation methodologies in that it considers not the historical cost or the book value of the backbone facilities, but it considers the replacement cost of those facilities when we're determining what is the cost of that capacity within the system. It includes infrastructure development over the next 5 years, and indeed, over the next 5 years, Owosso anticipates another $50 million plus in infrastructure development. As I said, it's a relatively new method over the last decade or two, has gained, though, in recent years an acceptance and has become one of three industry standards. We feel that it was the best approach for Owosso's calculation methodology, however, because it does indeed, for some of the reasons that I've stated, accurately reflects the true cost of that system development for the capacity that is included in the system. Here's the departure from the calculations in the past. It also includes the principal on outstanding debt as a portion of that cost. Indeed, with the level of infrastructure or of capital investment required by the water and sewer utilities to meet demand and remain sustainable well into the future, we could not do it through cash funding alone. So there's a substantial amount of debt involved as well. So this calculation does involve the principal on outstanding debt. However, for that new customer, when the fee is calculated, there is a credit given for the principal payments that customer will be making over time, as long as they're a customer, through the regular, a small portion of that is recovered also through the monthly charges as well. So a credit is given back so that we're not double charging any new customer for back or payment of the debts that's already been retired in addition to future debt payments. So they do get a credit there. But the real take-home point for this particular methodology is that with all of the assumptions that are built into the total plant in service calculation method, it is the one that most closely places the cost burden of growth on growth rather than emphasizing any additional burden, or it minimizes any additional burden on existing customers. And that is a philosophy of our board of directors, fully endorsed by the staff, that growth should pay for growth rather than existing customers. We're just finishing a comprehensive rate study. And the reason you do that is because we are obliged to operate under cost of service rate setting methodologies. We'll talk about why that is in just a moment. But and what you do with the rate study is it trues up those cost of service principles within your entire rate structure. The last study that we conducted was completed in 1998, so we've had a significant interval between the rate studies. What happens during that interval, however, is that we still apply cost of service methodology, but we generally are, by identifying our revenue needs, and that revenue need is synonymous with cost recovery for the system, for the capital investment, the operating expenses, and the debt. And then we will apply across the board rate adjustments to ensure that we recover that needed cost recovery. But as I say, when you do a subsequent rate study, you kind of true up between the water and sewer utilities exactly where the allocations for that cost exist, and then you make an adjustment in your rate structure to recover appropriately where those costs are allocated. During that interim since 1998, however, we have spent almost $150 million in capital investment in the infrastructure, in developing additional capacity and sustainability. Well over 60% of that was for the wastewater utility. And indeed, over the next 5 years, I mentioned $50 million that we'll be spending on top of what we've done in these last 8 or 9 years. But $28 million of that is also earmarked for wastewater infrastructure development as well. So what this means, basically, is when we have, as I mentioned earlier, the calculation does take into consideration the next 5 years of capital development. And also, when you look at what has been spent between water and the wastewater utilities, a great example is the Mason Farm Wastewater Treatment Plant. In 2004, we began construction there for an expansion and upgrade of that facility to the tune of $50 million, clearly the largest capital project we ever embarked upon. But I give that as an example, once again, to help you see the how the investment in recent years and in the next few immediate years has been more on the wastewater side. So what this means, then, when we take a look at the trued-up allocations of cost between the two utilities, the water and sewer utility, and then calculate the rates to recover from those customers using each of those facilities, it has created, because of this extensive spending in favor of the wastewater utility, a need to recover more of the cost from that utility. And another reason that we're seeing an increase in the magnitude that we've discussed in the letter in the rate adjustment is also, as I mentioned earlier, we're now including the principal on outstanding debt in the calculation. And that has, going back to that mathematical formula, that goes into the numerator and straight math. You increase the numerator, then the ending quotient is going to be higher. And as the letter previously sent to you by Mr. Clark has indicated, we're looking at 11 and 40% adjustments in the service availability fees for the water and wastewater utilities, respectively, for the reasons that I've just stated. That such a difference there because of the extensive spending on the wastewater side. Adjustments to our rates are proposed to be effective on October 1st, which sort of dovetails nicely with local government's budgeting process, and also we have a 90-day notification requirement with the university, so the October 1st date is a good target for Orange Water and Sewer. And but here's a very important point to remember as well. As a finance officer, it strikes me as important to make sure that you're reminded of this, that as OWASA operates as an enterprise fund, we have no taxing authority. Grants these days are far and in between. So essentially, all of our funding is coming through the rate structure. Fair to say there is very little other source for our revenue stream. So again, the point there is that the utility recovers all of its costs strictly through the rate structure. And because we do operate under that constraint as a enterprise fund or as a utility, it creates for our board of directors a policy choice when it comes to service availability fees. As I said earlier, the fees are designed to recover from new customers their fair share of existing and soon-to-be-developed capacity. And the idea that the board is committed to as a policy decision is that growth or new customers should pay for that additional capacity. Because we our only revenue stream is from rates, if we depart from cost of service methodology, and adjust downward the service availability fees, what that means then is that we would have to adjust other fees upwards to recover that cost, thereby increasing the burden for growth on existing customers. And, of course, we're not, even though we are locked in to certain constraints having to do with how we set rates and what our revenue, the source of our revenue streams are, we're not at all insensitive to the concept or the concerns of affordability. A couple of points I would make about affordability, however, is that because of our agreements of sale and purchase with the towns and the university, as well as our bond covenants with our bondholders, we do not have the ability. We are constrained against setting rates based on a customer's ability to pay. What that literally means is that someone making minimum wage must pay, according to all the covenants and agreements that we're involved in, the same amount for that first 1,000 gallons of water as someone who is quite wealthy. That's a constraint that we simply are not allowed through all of our contractual agreements to step out. We are required to use that cost of service rate-setting methodology, and there's specific language that precludes any sort of discriminatory rate-setting amongst customers within a single class. However, because we are not insensitive to the concept of affordability, back in 1998, arising from the previous rate study, we did find that we could depart from an older traditional method of calculating these fees, where it was sort of a broad brush approach, and we did find that there was supportable, defensible data, or there were data that indicated defensibly that the smaller the home, the less water that is generally used. And so based on that knowledge, we were able to develop a multi-tiered approach to the service availability fees, so that while the actual water rate per 1,000 gallons is the same for each of our customers under the existing rate structure, the service availability fees were lessened significantly for owners of smaller homes, and it's graduated up to a larger amount for the larger homes. Then again in 2001, and if I'm not mistaken, I do believe that it was the then mayor and representatives from this board that came to us asking, was there anything else we could do in terms of affordability as it related to our service availability fees? We went back to that data, scoured it even further, and we did find that there was supportable information or evidence that said that there we could create yet a smaller size of the residence, and so we did come up with yet another tier on the lower end to further reduce the availability fees for and then made these fees somewhat more affordable. Also, in terms of looking forward for how we might be able to keep these fees affordable, is that we're open to innovation. We're open to ideas there. One in particular that we've been talking about internally is exploring this concept of water smart construction. And there, if a home is built that we can be assured is ultra efficient in terms of water use, then it makes sense that we could offer some sort of credit within the rate structure to accommodate that knowledge. Because what that means is the capacity requirement for that connection would be lowered, and so. But that would not be, we could attempt to do that unilaterally, but I would suggest that those kinds of explorations would best perhaps be accomplished through some joint ventures and joint exploration between the various jurisdictions. We don't have planning and building inspection departments, for example, that sort of thing, but I think there may be a real win-win situation there where there might be some joint effort. And our next steps normally at OWASA we need to finish up all of the work in the rate study. There are still a few little miscellaneous fees and charges that are not complete. Then we intend to make this information public and announce and invite the public to come and share with the board their concerns and thoughts on the rate adjustments during our May 10th Board of Directors meeting, and then again during a public hearing on rates in conjunction also with our annual budget public hearing on May 24th. Also, prior to that public hearing, we It's the intention of staff and the board to provide to each of the jurisdictions additional information and a briefing on the total rate structure. As mentioned early in the presentation, these are just one component of all of our rates. Then ultimately, as would normally happen, we would hope to adopt these rates to become effective October 1st, but adopt them in our first meeting in June along with the annual budget. And with that, as Mac or Mr. Clark said, we stand ready to answer any questions.
Let me point out, I apologize, I should have mentioned earlier that our newest member of the OWASA board, who I think was just appointed, was it last week or the week before, but he's here with us, Braxton Fushi, former Alderman Braxton Fushi. Good to see you, Braxton. And if you have some comment on this topic, please feel free to come up. Okay.
Braxton will actually officially become a member of the board this Thursday. He will be sworn in.
All right, sworn in this Thursday and then cussed out no later than Friday, I'm sure. all right. I have a couple of questions, but board members.
We have a list of questions.
If you don't mind my just jumping right in. One question I have, one thing about the way the system works both now and under your proposed changes, if someone buys a vacant lot in the OWASA service area and builds a 3,000-square-foot house, which is actually getting to be fairly typical of the kind of construction that's going on in the OWASA service area, they pay, I think it's the top tier of impact fee.
Over 3,800 square feet is actually the very top tier.
That's good. So if they build a 3,800 square foot house, then they pay in the top tier, which is quite a few thousand, $7,000-$8,000. It's considerable amount of money. However, if same person or if some comparably situated person bought a 1,000 square foot house that's been connected to OWASA for many years and did a 2,800 square foot addition to the house, the result would be the same. Presumably, the result would be the same or almost exactly the same in terms of the added impact on OWASA's sewer treatment capacity and water treatment, drinking water treatment capacity, but because they're not establishing a new OWASA service connection in that process, they're not asked to pay any additional tap fees because they're not establishing a new tap. Do you follow what I'm getting at?
Okay.
And I guess what I'm curious about is not necessarily right this moment, but whether any utilities anywhere are trying to address that question, and whether there may be a way for us to make sure that we're treating people who are similarly situated in a similar way.
Well, I can feel that. The situation you've described can happen, and it can happen often. It's one of the reasons that I suggested that as we explore maybe some alternatives to when it comes to water efficient use in the building code or in buildings, is that we don't necessarily have the resources or the connections to know if someone has increased the finished space of the home. However, anecdotally, I can tell you that in the past, where we had an application for let's just say it was 2,000 square feet. But we did, by chance, if you will, discover that the application may have said that may have been the original construction. But, as I say, by chance, we discovered that they had added another 1,500 square feet. We did go to that customer and talk to them about what these capacity fees were about and did indeed assess them the difference.
Well, I think we should – that's good. And if there's something that our inspections department can do to assist in being aware of those situations, I'd like us to explore how we might share relevant information with OWASA about the size of house that building permits are issued for to try and coordinate what we're doing here. But I think I would also like it to suggest to you that we explore, because although you don't have a way of knowing when somebody's doing a 1,500-square-foot addition to their house, we usually do, hopefully, we do know about those situations because people should be pulling building permits, and generally they are. So I believe and I don't know whether North Carolina law, utility law, would allow us to find a way to do that, but if utility law doesn't allow us to do it, then that's a subject that at some point we ought to raise with our legislative delegation, because if we're going to apply these cost of service principles, then we ought to apply them, and that would be a logical extension of that.
Certainly it doesn't seem to me to be an insuperable problem to have some formal process by which Carver and Chapel Hill in this specific case should advise OISA whenever they receive a building permit application for anything significant. I'm not sure what significant might be, maybe more than 500 square feet or something of that nature.
Right.
But we could then explore, and again, I'm unclear on what the law might be and what complications might be, but certainly that would seem to me to be the first step.
I have another question, but if it's on that same topic.
Yeah, this just piggybacks. Wouldn't it make sense if one were to put together some sort of system of that kind to use the cut points that are already outlined in your rate structure as the trigger points at which the town would need to share information? That way the town isn't necessarily shuffling through every single building permit whenever somebody's, adding some kitchen space or something, but can share information that would clearly be relevant to that, and it would only, and from your perspective, it would only have an effect if the cumulative square footage reached one of your cut points. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
Right.
Yes.
So that would. That would be how you'd probably want to do that.
That'd be a logical way to approach it.
And I think the importance of doing this is fairness, because as Kevin has mentioned, to the extent that we undercharge for access, in other words, if some people get access without paying for it or some portion of it, in the end that inevitably must be reflected in the monthly usage fees, because in any given year we have to budget for a certain amount of money. If we don't get it from one source, we must necessarily get it from another source.
Or in other words, us. That is to say, us ratepayers.
I've got another question.
Let me go into one other area, which has more to do with your presentation. Now, if I understood what you were saying correctly, then part of what drives the significant there are several factors that drive the proposed increase. But if I understand it correctly, one of the changes is the result of switching from looking at the question of how to distribute our actual past investment as ratepayers in the capital infrastructure that we already have to looking at what the replacement cost of those assets would be. In other words, you don't look at the $1 million we spent on University Lake, you look at the $5 million that it would cost to replace University Lake or that type of thing. Have I got the general?
Yes.
I made up the figures. But.
In principle, that's correct. It is more sophisticated, as Kevin has pointed out, in that we look at that replacement cost and we depreciate it back, because what the new customer is buying, that particular piece of equipment, it's not a new piece, but it's an older piece, so it has to be depreciated back.
Because University Lake is 75 years old or whatever.
And then we also have to make some allowance for the fact that as the new customer, in the rates that they're paying every month, will be some element to service bonds which lie behind that investment in that particular plant. So the calculation is more sophisticated than it might appear on the surface, but in principle you're right.
I guess here's where I was headed with asking about, making sure I understood that issue, is, even though the depreciated cost of the depreciated amount of the replacement cost of a particular asset might I mean, that clearly that I can see how that's a valid way of analyzing the problem, but it seems a little problematic to me because, in fact, we don't have to replace. I mean, what the basically our future capital costs don't, for the most part, lie in the replacement of University Lake or the replacement of Cane Creek Reservoir, because there's no, I mean, in other words,
surely,
if you were really to amortize those assets over the length of time that they'll last, it would be hundreds of years, hopefully.
If anything, those particular assets and land itself will appreciate rather than depreciate.
Well, right. But I guess my point being that we don't have any plan to either replace Cane Creek Reservoir or to build another reservoir, period. So how is it logical? So I guess what I'm getting at is, okay, so we may have to in the future expand, well, we will have to in the future expand our water treatment plant. And I can see asking new people who move to the area to pay something to help offset those future costs, and asking them to pay something to offset the past costs of the existing water treatment plant, I can see that seems fair too, but what is the real logic in saying, well, you should pay for what it would cost to replace something that we don't actually have any plan to replace? Or do I just not understand?
Well, again, when you try and get into the arithmetic, it's a lot more complex than,
sure,
than it might appear. But clearly, if we take the water treatment plant, that cost a whole series of investments of various prices, and let's just say we spend in total $50 million or whatever the number is.
Right.
Now, today, to replace that plant, if that plant disappeared and we had to build a whole new plant, it would cost, let's say, $75 million. But it would be unfair to say to a new customer, okay, you've got to pay your share in relation to the amount of capacity you're going to use of $75 million, because that plant that's sitting there is not new, which it would be if we had to build a whole new plant.
Right.
So we depreciate the elements in that plant. The major elements are taken and depreciate according to how long they've been there and so on,
right,
to arrive at today's value, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the basis. Does that answer the
Well, I guess, that sort of answers the question. So I can see how that's a valid way of saying what is the value of the investment that past ratepayers have, you know, present ratepayers have already made in the system, but I guess what's troubling is because of inflation in engineering costs and construction costs and so forth that vastly outstrips like the consumer price index, for example, the number you come up with is, say, hypothetically, that the depreciated replacement cost of the water treatment plant is $60 million, even though the ratepayers actually only have ever invested $50 million, and I don't know whether that is how that I don't know whether that's the scale or type of result you get, but I guess I'm just saying, well, so, but I'm not sure that I fully see how it's fair to ask people to use the $60 million rather than the $50 million.
I think we're getting into a fair degree of detail here,
I think an important philosophical question about how you're doing this, about how you're approaching it. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes. Well, we think we are now approaching this in a method which best reflects the true value of the fixed assets at the moment. But I would agree, it's a debatable point. As Kevin mentioned, there are kind of three basic methods which are currently used in the industry to do this. And the method which we are now proposing to use is one which is rapidly increasing in popularity because it does seem to be the fairest one. So that's why we've decided to do it in this way.
I don't understand it, but it doesn't necessarily seem like the fairest one to me in the sense that, for example, It would cost us a lot more to replace Hank Anderson Park than right now than we ever invested in it to begin with. But still, all that our taxpayers are asked to pay is what it costs us now to own it.
But if you acquired another let me try and put it this way: if you acquired another piece of land, it became part of Carbra, and the people who were in that area had to then buy into that park. Should they buy it in at the original cost that it might have been, say, 50 years ago?
Yeah.
Well, and the answer to that question is, and here's what I'm trying to get to, is the answer to that question is no, they should buy in at a rate that reflects what it would cost to add more parks. But that's because for each new household that arrives, we need more parks. And granted, for each new household that arrives, we need more sewer capacity and we need more water treatment capacity. But I guess the question I'm getting at is, but there are some OWASA assets that we won't need any more of that don't necessarily need to be expanded in order to accommodate residential growth. Do you follow me? Because, for
sure.
Example,
yeah.
Like I said, we're not planning on building any more reservoirs, as far as I know.
Now, stick my neck out and assume that this will, or I'm hopeful that this will help narrow that equity gap that you've described that's in your mind. When you talk about that escalated replacement cost, your argument is well followed and well understood. I, in fact, not at all unsympathetic. I believe what narrows the gap, though, once that amount or future value is determined, it's brought back to a net present value. So, in essence, today's customer is buying what it would cost to replace it today.
Mm-hmm. Not sure I agree, but I understand.
Well, Mark, you just asked something interesting when you said purchasing another reservoir, and I'm wondering, is the stone quarry, is that part of this equation as well? I mean, is that something that...
The stone quarry already belongs to OWASA. Technically, the operation, which is still quarrying in the stone quarry, pays us a rental. I think it's $1 a year,
right.
And they are required to continue excavating and so on until 2030. But today that already belongs to us. So,
but to reconfigure that, based on Mark's idea, to reconfigure that, are those the kind of costs that we're talking about? Is that what you're getting at, Mark?
Well, that's not the issue I was getting at, but it's an interesting one.
I must say our focus on this is more on the assets, which are clearly depreciable. I mean, land and reservoirs and so on do not, by and large, depreciate. I mean, for example, at Cane Creek, which is an operating reservoir, clearly the dam and the pumps and so on, they depreciate, but the lake mm-hmm. itself and the mm-hmm. land and so on, that does not depreciate. Mm-hmm. In fact, it appreciates.
Mm-hmm.
I think what our focus has been much more on is in the physical assets, which are part of the working equipment, if you like, of OWASA, which does deteriorate, the water plant, the wastewater treatment plant, the pipes in the ground, and so on.
Jackie.
I have a series of questions. The first two are very simple. The connectivity fee and the availability fee are the same fee. Is that correct?
Yes. In water utilities or in utilities of this nature, there are a variety of names given to essentially the same
okay,
thing.
Okay, because I know that confuses citizens and they'll
we did have some debate about changing the name, but decided to stick with accessibility fee, which is what we have used for some time.
Okay. As you know, one of the next items on our agenda is Carolina North. Will the university be paying the same connectivity availability fee as everybody else?
Yes, it's a short answer. Now, originally the university had an exemption from these fees.
I understand, yeah.
But that was renegotiated several years ago, and they have now completed their free connection area.
Right.
And
okay.
Even on main campus now for new connections, they pay the fees.
Okay.
And, of course, wholly for Carolina okay. North.
As you were talking about setting the fees, it occurred to me that a very good standard wouldn't be house size, but lawn size. I'm a firm believer that, to quote myself, that grass makes you stupid. And I think, you know, if it's grass free, lower the fee, you know, and it's so, grass is so expensive for all of us. Even though, you know, I realize that people that have big lawns are charged more for that water, but I think that's just a fraction of what the water actually costs the community. I know they're actually paying for the delivery of the water because water kind of is a gift from God and belongs to all of us. and it's the delivery that we're paying for.
Just to put the pipes in, as somebody said.
Right. But not only, you know, if you have a big lawn, are you using more water than you need? I remember the great drought of '02. It was the lawns that were really killing us. It wasn't, you know, it didn't matter, you know, if I watered my plants with my leftover dishwater, that was nice, but it was these huge lawns. So they cost in using water when water is rare, and water will become rarer as we continue to grow. They cost in the delivery of water. But mainly, you know, we are all looking at having to pay an exorbitant amount of money in order to deal with water runoff before it hits Lake Jordan. A lot of that is the lawn hogs. You know, they may be paying for the water, and they will eventually pay for what we have to do through their taxes, but they are costing the community an incredible amount of money for their patch of green. So I would very much like to see, and not just as an idea to explore, but as something to actually happen if you go forward with this, that if people are using low water usage landscaping, then the fee diminishes it, because the lawns are really what is driving so much of the crises we're dealing with, and it's just ridiculous. As you can see, it's my soapbox, But I think, you know, what you're looking at, you're caused to focus very narrowly on this one thing, and yet the lawns really are a huge issue from many different sides, not just from the ACP. Are you addressing that? And if not, I would strongly request that you do.
Let me try and address that briefly. First of all, about the accessibility fees, which are our focus tonight. If you look at the tabulation of proposed accessibility fees, and looking at the scale from the smallest dwelling, that is less than 1,300 square feet, to the highest, 3,800 square feet, the ratio of the sewer accessibility fee is about 2-1 in round figures. In other words, it's roughly twice as much for that biggest house as it is for the smallest house. But in contrast, for water, the ratio is about 6-1. And if you think about it, this represents a logical representation of what happens.
Except by doing that, we're encouraging and allowing the big new houses to have big new lawns. And we may be able to separate out the two and say, yeah, just because you have a big house doesn't mean that you have to have a big lawn. Well, you can have something better.
Well, first of all, the accessibility, I said, because obviously, if you have a lawn, you use a lot more water, and you're perfectly correct there, and we are strongly conservation-minded. But going back for the sewer fee at the moment, clearly if there are four people living in a house, whether it's a 2,000-square-foot house or a 5,000-square-foot house, the use of the sewer facilities, that is, from toilet flushing, dishwashing, and all the other in-house uses, basically, which is where the water goes down the sewer, does not vary a great deal. So, hence, the variability from the small house to the large house on sewer fees is relatively small. But on water use, and this has been prepared from examining statistics, and the paper which was attached to my letter deals with that. It's a little historical, I know, but nonetheless I think gives you the general background of the thinking. The ratio for water fees is roughly 6-1. Now tonight I don't want to get into the rest of the proposals on the rate structure, but very briefly, one of the proposals, you'll see this if you've seen the leaflet that is just coming out with the water bills in the Green Thumb, how the new rates will operate. We are introducing for single-family residences what's called an inverted block structure, which means as you increase your usage, that each block of usage is much more expensive per 1,000 gallons than the preceding block. And this is how we will discourage people from using large quantities of water to irrigate their lawns.
I understand that, and I remember when it was being developed. I think what I'm saying, though, is that as new housing is being built, if the availability fee / connection fee was lower for those units that did not, regardless of size, for those units that were not using water-intensive landscaping and instead were using low-water landscaping, if that connectivity rate was lower, it could benefit the community in many, many ways, including financially as we struggle to deal with the runoff from the lawn.
Well, I would comment, Kevin mentioned the idea of smart growth, smart housing. And certainly I would see in principle there should not be any reason why, for example, appropriate landscaping could not be part of the pattern. I think the problem might be in seeing that it's maintained in that way. This is always one of the problems, I think, in this sort of operation. But nevertheless, in concept, I think that's something we could look at.
Okay. Thanks. Alex?
Just briefly, too. Now, just to clarify, in Exhibit 5, the numbers that you are citing are from 1998. Is that correct?
Yeah.
I think for the purposes of this discussion, it doesn't really matter, but I think for discussions moving forward, I think it would be very useful to show what the proposed new rate structure will be in comparison with
sure.
this. I mean, I found this to be a useful illustrative tool to demonstrate how the tiering works. But the real numbers, I think, are what...
Sure. The numbers are already available. We've got them. We discussed them at the last board meeting, or the one before, was it?
Two meetings back, yes.
So, sure, we can make these available to you.
That'd be handy. And this is sort of going back to the question that Mark raised earlier, and this is more for clarification. Now, in including principal on outstanding debt, that is one of the changes. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So under the current system, you're financing current principal strictly through the ratepayer structure. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
See, yeah. That's something that's a little problematic for me as well, which is now beginning to backcharge for outstanding principal when nobody up to this point has paid for outstanding principal through the availability fee structure. That's a philosophical issue, but I find that an issue which is a little troubling. It reminds me a little bit of, it's not the same. I understand that it's different, but back when in the 80s when CP&L this was actually the reverse. CP&L was banking was essentially banking through the ratepayers anticipated debt for capacity that they hadn't even anticipated, and in fact, after a very lengthy battle, I believe the courts found that to be illegal. And so, what you're doing isn't the same, but the same kind of principle applies, and I have just a little bit of an equity issue with it. And I think that's something that Joel was concerned about as well. I mean, to bring this up was this was something she was, it's too bad that she's held up, because I know that she had some really detailed questions that she wanted answered, and I'm not sure if we're covering all of her stuff here, but...
We can certainly look at that, Kevin, can't we?
Indeed. A comment I would make in response to that. I think that it's important to point out also that historically, or rather, we are entering an era for water and sewer utilities that departs from where we've been historically, just in terms of the infrastructure development and rehabilitation and expansion that's going to be required, not just here in Chapel Hill Carborough, but also around the world, but in particular in the United States. The estimates over the next 20 to 30 years are that from hundreds of billions to into the trillions of dollars of infrastructure development capital needs. And as you have seen over the last few years in observing what our rate adjustments have looked like, we have been preparing for that, and in fact, with our measured approach and rate adjustments, the idea is that we are able to begin now to fund rehabilitation and sustainable aspects of the infrastructure, also that we're able to prepare for the expansion. So it really is becoming a whole new scenario, and I would suggest that as we mentioned some of the numbers we've spent in the last 8 or 9 years, over the next 15, it's going to be another very large number. I suggest the scenario is changing, is that with that level of required infrastructure investment that everyone is facing, including Owosso, would that not, in my mind, it helps to justify the change in shifting it now to those new customers that will be creating this new demand. Is it entirely appropriate to continue to let existing customers pay for that new scenario?
My problem isn't with using the fee structure to meet new demand and to meet new capital needs. Obviously, that's what it's designed to do, and that's what you're trying to do. Where I run into a little bit of difficulty is when you are charging for outstanding principal, right, on completed projects or completed financing, when that was not part of that structure before. That's where I have an issue. I mean, when you take on new debt, obviously a new principal to finance the needed expansion and needed capacity, of course, it's perfectly reasonable to try to recover those costs through, obviously, the combination, but to try to recover as much of that cost as you possibly can through the availability fee structure, as long as there's built-in equity to it. That's all. I'm not trying to belabor the point, but you see where the juxtaposition can
be.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming tonight.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to us.
And thank you for all you do all the time. I know it's a very hard job, so to both of you, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now that Jackie said that, though, you can't say it's thankless. all right. Board members, actually, unless there's objection, I'd like to suggest that we go real quickly. I know some of us may have to leave before the meeting is over. Can we skip to item number 4 on our agenda? Unless there's any discussion we need for appointments to the Board of Adjustment, there's been
item
4 recommendations put before us. Been okay. Moved and seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
Speaker Harvey saying aye. All those opposed? Matter passes unanimously. Thanks very much. We're on agenda item number 2 now. Presentation and overview of the Carrboro Revolving Loan Fund. Mr. Manager?
Okay. Purpose of this item is to provide the Board of Aldermen with an overview of the Revolving Loan Fund and review the process and criteria used by the fund to start or expand businesses in Carrboro.
And thank you, James.
James Harris, our Community and Economic Development Director, is approaching the podium and also passing out additional information for you all.
Good evening. The purpose of this item is to respond to a request from the Board of Aldermen at the annual retreat to make an overview presentation of the Carrboro Revolving Loan Fund. What I've done is I've gone back and sort of done a history of the Revolving Loan Fund, and I'll just do that. I know you have it in front of you, but the people in the audience may not have it. This loan fund is exactly 21 years old. It was established in April of 1986. And it was established using funds from some repaid loans from the North Carolina Department of Natural Resources. Those loans were from Rogers Trium, Clara Sterling, and Norena Jade Palace. The only funds that exist in this pool are funds that came from the original allocation, plus any principal and interest that have been paid by loan recipients. And if you look on that sheet, you'll see that we have a healthy fund balance there.
And excuse me for just a minute.
Yes.
So somebody says that all these loans that are being made to small businesses come out of Carrboro taxpayers giving money to small businesses. That's not true, is it?
That is not true.
Thank you.
It comes from the proceeds from those three original loans. We have a partnership with the SBTDC. They serve as our loan packager for the town. They've done it for about 2 or 3 years now. They're doing an excellent job. The way that they're paid is each applicant is charged 2% of the loan proceeds for their services. And it's it works very well, and we've been doing that for a while. And they pay 2% for that. These funds can be used for a series of things. It can be used to fund nonprofit and for-profit entities. The people applying for the funds can use these funds to buy equipment. They can buy supplies to be resold in the business. They can upfit their building. They can purchase land, although we've never had anyone do that. The use of the funds are restricted to our planning jurisdiction. You cannot use it outside of our planning jurisdiction. It's purely for Carrboro people. Okay. On your spreadsheet, I'll just walk down this for you. As of March 30th, we have cash equity in the amount of $429,000. A part of that $429,000 is $40,000 that was made to our science resource learning project. I've got to contact them to make sure they're still needing that money. If they're not, then we will put it back into the fund so we could loan that out to other people. So you'll see that figure, $389,430. That would be what's available if we subtracted the $40,000. Yes.
I know you don't have this tonight, but at some point it would be interesting to see the grand total during the past 21 years of how much money has been lent out and how much money has been recouped, including interest. That would be, like, the grand totals of both of those, I think, would be quite an impressive number. So I'm not asking you to stand there and add it up right now, but I think that would be impressive.
Okay.
I thought James gave us that information not too long ago.
Yeah.
Didn't you do a?
I did.
Yeah, you did a full one, didn't you?
Yeah, but I can get that information.
Yes, it was.
I can get that information for you. What I've done is I've done a sampling of the history at year-end audit, and if you look at the second set of numbers, 6/30/1990, we had $55,372 available to be loaned. On 6/30/2000, we had $254,262, and on 6/30/06, we had $292,787. So you can see how the fund accrues. Okay.
James, yeah. Do you know the payoff dates on these the seven outstanding loans?
That was one of those things you asked me for, and yes, I'm not here, but I do have the information.
Okay.
I'll put the sheet and just email it to you. I'm sorry. Okay. And as estimated for 6/30/07, we'll have $412,000. And I made a note to myself that the reason that number is kind of high, sometimes we have people pay their loans off early. Crazy Maze closed, and when they sold their train cars, they repaid the full loan. So that bumped us up. So that's why that's kind of high. Cumulative interest repayment since inception, this is just the interest that we actually charge, with $240,754. We also earn income, investment income on those funds, and we've earned $196,652 since inception. And I've listed for you all the outstanding loans, the current outstanding loans that we have with the balances, so you can see that. And then I projected for you, and I didn't do all these numbers. I must turn to Bing and say, Bing, and I worked on these numbers today so we could have them for you. Outstanding total is $215,480 of monies owed to us now from the existing loans. The principal repayments between now and for the next 3 months, the end of the year, $7,203. For an estimated outstanding loans at 6/30/07 of $208,277, because you'd have to back out the principal repayment of $7,000. Okay. And then in that last little block down there, it just shows you some more projected incomes between now and the end of the year. Okay. So,
James, thanks for this update or review of the program, and I think it reemphasizes the point that I know this entire board is already aware of, that this is a really great program. We do a lot of good work through, have done and are doing a lot of good work through this program. I guess I have a couple of questions about it. I know you and I discussed within the last couple of weeks the possibility of working with a nonprofit organization in Durham to try and help good work, whatever it's called, to try and help educate potential entrepreneurs about what the process of starting a business would be like, or expanding a business and developing a business plan, that type of thing. Where's your thinking on that possibility?
Actually, we're thinking about using the SBTDC, and we're following on Michael Schumann's conversation here with us about growing small businesses and doing the leakage analysis, which we're still trudging along on because we're waiting for him. If we could identify the gaps in services or businesses that we don't have in the town of Carver, then we could take that information and actually go out with like an RFP to the community and say, here are the businesses that we're missing. Would you like to start a new business? And we'd like to do a training program for them. Mm-hmm. And it's actually in the budget, and it's still there. It's hanging in there. And okay. What will happen is those people will get some additional training on how to start a business, how to do that business plan, and how to do those projections. It'll give us a more secure position when they come in to apply for the funds, because they won't just be walking off the street. They'll have a little bit of training under their belt.
Right.
Staying
on that topic.
Yeah, we did that about 8 or 9 years ago.
Yes.
And I know that Trish with the social club, 5 or 6, you know, we got the social club out of that and several other businesses. So I'm really glad to see it popping up again. That's good stuff.
Yeah, I think that would be a really good step in the right direction with a good way to increase or broaden the accessibility is really, I guess, what I mean to say for this program. The other item I wanted to ask about, and I mentioned this, I think, at the retreat, but, you know, there are lots of good rules, I think, involving the revolving loan fund in this, it's on attachment B1, revolving loan fund criteria, that help to ensure that we're first of all, that our loan is setting people up for success rather than failure, you know, insisting that they have a good plan and that they have a budget and mm-hmm. have really thought through the implications of taking out their loan, which I think is really good. And not only for the borrower, but it also protects us or our fund as a lender to make sure that that the debt's not going to go bad and that the money is really needed for the project. I guess the one concern I have is under item number 13, there's a requirement the applicant must be turned down by at least 2 banks. Mm-hmm. Is one requirement, and then another requirement which seems very similar is must demonstrate that without this assistance, the proposed activity would not be possible and low to moderate benefit requirement would not be met. So here's my question both to the staff and to the board. Is that first requirement that you be turned down by at least 2 banks really necessary, given that we have another requirement that they have to demonstrate somehow that without the assistance, the proposed activity would not be possible? And because those 2 things are sort of the same. It's just that the requirement of the two bank rule is basically much more, is a very specific way in which one might demonstrate the broader, more broadly stated criteria, or meeting the more broadly stated criterion. And the reason that I really ask that is that, you know, potentially to apply for a loan to a bank in a situation where the application is likely to be marginal and where the applicant may be turned down for the loan, can reflect badly on the credit rating of the potential borrower. That is, say you can injure your credit score by asking for money that you are not given or that you are not loaned. And so I want, unless staff thinks there's a real specific need for that requirement, I think it would make more sense for us to remove that requirement and simply rely on the broader language that you must demonstrate that without this assistance, the proposed activity would not be possible. So,
I got a comment.
Yeah, cool. I'm sorry.
We need some documented method to show us that they really need it. If we don't have that letter from the bank saying that they cannot get it, and sometimes they won't tell them, you don't qualify for the loan. What they'll say is, you have a pretty good proposal in front of us. It's very risky. We will do a portion of it. Then Carver becomes a lender, a bridge lender in that instance. And then we make a portion of the loan and take part of the risk, and the bank would take a portion of the risk. My concern is if we don't have the bank give a level of review, how would we document the need? How would they demonstrate the need for the money? And I'm willing to look into it.
And so you're saying they don't need to be turned down by the bank. They need to be, I guess, partially turned down by the bank. Get less than they need for the
bank. They advised by the bank, you might say. Well, Alex is waiting here. Sorry.
To some degree, this is a philosophical question, which is the whole program was designed to open up entrepreneurship opportunities for those who otherwise wouldn't have them. And so the sort of basic theory behind that is that if you can secure conventional financing, well, do that. The basic function of the program is not to be first resort cheap money for entrepreneurs who can just do it otherwise. I mean, the fund is large, it's healthy, and so we can support a large number of businesses, but there is a focus to it. I understand where you're going with that, but I would suggest that we need to tread carefully. And James, of course, I think has articulated just some practical issues.
Mark, you would know more about this than I do, but it seems to me that if you ask people for some basic information that shows their financial status, that you could look at that and pretty much tell whether a bank was going to turn them down, couldn't you?
Well, I mean that's one potential approach. I mean, I think with the clarification that you've made, James, that this requirement is not necessarily as burdensome as it sounds.
Right.
But so then maybe it should sound more like what it is, and maybe what's really needed is to just restate that a little bit differently, because to me, and I first stumbled across that requirement when I was considering the possibility of a loan from this fund on behalf of an organization that I was working with quite some time ago, and it really jumped off the page at me, because I thought, that doesn't work. I don't want to do that. I don't want to go out and apply for a loan and be turned down by two banks just to get access to this. So maybe it's simply a matter of that there's a different way that we could state that requirement that would still meet the need you're articulating, but not necessarily because I do think a lot of people who have a certain degree of business savvy might be put off by that.
So would it be sufficient to have some documentation of risk analysis rather than actually being turned down?
I would just suggest that we ask that if people are interested in this that we ask the staff to try to work up a proposed.
Sure. I think it's also worth.
I know I'm late.
Go ahead.
But on the board, I'm one of two people who actually worked for an institution that lent money, and lent it to money to people who were not always thought of as the best risks with larger financial institutions. So on the one hand, there are other avenues, and one of the things the board needs to think about is when I'm thinking about this. This is taxpayers' money. That's the first thing. So we can't just while we may like somebody and we may want to have a business with them, they have to have some financial wherewithal to have the money. I mean, I'm sort of the Martin Eakes person. You shouldn't get bad credit. You should be able to get good credit. And so you don't really want people to get bad credit. On the other hand, we don't want to impair our ability to successfully fund small businesses. And I think there should be a level of criteria, also of initiative, that you've actually looked to see if you could get money somewhere else. And so I would be careful, I would caution the board, because there are institutions that ask for this type of data to determine whether or not you should fit in their particular loan program. And it is a common thing. The SBI does it. Not the SBI, but the SBA. I'm sorry. No one might take any allusion to that. I'm driving down the street.
We'll check your credit, too.
And so I would caution the board that there needs to be a level of standard that we have, and thus far it has worked very well. And although it might be time-consuming to provide additional documentation, there has to be some level of documentation so the board, as a policy entity, can say, because we're the ones who vote on the loans, they have done what they were supposed to do. I mean, it's sort of like when you go to the bank, they ask you for documentation if you want a loan for a house. And, you know, there's some people on the board that say, well, you know, we won't take your house if you loan, you know, if we loan money. But that may be something that we want to do. And if you put a person in a position who should not have gotten a loan, then you're going to take their house because it's tax money. It's a difficult decision. And while you may feel like the barriers are too high at the front end, we want to know at the front end so we're not sitting in the back end talking to Mike about, well, how's our foreclosure going? I mean, you know, and we are entering, while people don't like to discuss it, we are entering a period where credit is going to be tighter for everyone due to the fact that the economy isn't doing as well as everyone would like to think it is. So I would caution the board that I'll look at the criteria, but I would caution the board that we need to know that whatever, if you're going to do it with Carbro money, it's not some fly-by-night idea and you've done your homework. And some of that applying to a bank requires you to fill out some data and know the state of your own finances. I'm done.
Yeah, I agree with y'all on that. And I also agree with Mark that the language on this can perhaps be made more friendly to the applicant. But changing tack a little bit, when I looked over this report, what really struck me was the fact that of the 600,000 or so of funds that we have available, only about a third are currently committed. And I would like to suggest that as a board that we ask staff to, or say perhaps challenge staff, to come back and tell us how we can double that. I think a reasonable amount, a reasonable goal, is to have two-thirds of those funds committed at any one time. That gives us $200,000 for applications that might still come in while others are being paid off. But it means we're really getting more, we're working this fund more. And I think Jane's outlined, you know, some steps he's taking that'll help us get there. But I think if we look, you know, if we set a bar and perhaps we can get some response from staff onto how, what types of activities they might undertake to get us there, might be a worthwhile endeavor.
Jackie.
I know one comment that I've heard, and this isn't towards any individual, it's more towards the process of things taking too long. So maybe we could get an outline of what the time frame should be and what happens within the time frame, so that we can kind of track inquiries and then when does the inquiry actually become activated and the process begin. But if we could keep track of the inquiries that come in, I know I've dealt with some folks that said, I just got tired of waiting through the system, so I went out and I found another way, which may have been a good thing because they were able to find another way. But I would like a timeline of how long it takes from the time somebody applies or makes an inquiry, actually talks to somebody, and the time they get the loan, so that we can give people that idea when they talk to us.
Can I just ask for something? If we're going to do that, then we should look at the average of how other similar situated institutions do it. Because you have to remember, we only have one person doing the loan revolving fund. And again, my experience, I mean, self-help, and we're a very lean organization. But there was more than one person processing the loan applications. There was more than one person going out and looking at the data. And then that person had to go to a credit committee to determine whether or not the loan was viable. So we required more than one person. And if we want to get things done faster, then the board, as a policy matter, knowing how tight our budget is, we need to decide whether we are going to apply more human resources to that particular priority.
All I'm asking for is a timeline that I can tell somebody from the time you make a phone call, it should take this long before your loan comes through. That's all I'm asking.
I know,
for
and I'm not
know.
Opposed to that, but I'm okay. saying it just having that
I guess
without
I'm sorry.
Without having some idea of how similarly situated organizations do it with the amount of resources they do it with.
I guess we'd have to look at some sort of an average, because I think James would tell you that inquiries come in all kinds of forms, from people with a half baked idea that they've done no homework on, that they're just fishing and asking James a lot of questions, and sometimes I think James asking you to kind of do the work for them, to folks who come in with some really good ideas. And so the person who comes in with that, well, I think I might like to do this and so, but I haven't really thought through it, James many times sends them out and says, you know, here's what you need to do, 1, 2, 3, 4, before we can even really have much to talk about. And so that could be a very long process if somebody's done nothing. And if I'm misstating something, James, please jump in. And then for those folks who come in and they've really, you know, they've already done some homework, it's a very different situation. So I'm James may have a good idea. I'm not sure exactly how to get to what I think you're
something
asking.
Something that needs to be clarified is that the program is very different from a conventional. It's not just a financing mechanism.
I
think what Steve was alluding to is you will have somebody come in the door with a great idea, but this, you know, completely half-assed notion of how they're going to actually go about doing anything. And so that's where James actually begins the process, where people are actually, and I think this is important for the public to know, where people with an idea are literally trained within the program through the SBTDC to become entrepreneurs. That's part of how this whole thing works.
I know, but I have heard from like established businesses that were looking to expand or people with solid ideas that it just took so long that they found other ways. So I would like to know when somebody approaches me how long if I would be able to tell them within a month, if you are following procedures, your application should be in front of the committee, or it should be. I'd like to be able to tell people that.
Well, maybe we could get an idea of about how long the process takes from the point where somebody formally applies.
If somebody brings in an application, it's pretty clear about what the process is. It's just from the point of that first contact to the application coming in, could be a wide range of times depending on how well thought out that initial idea might be.
It's the same issue with CUPs and SUPs. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, mm-hmm. well, right. from when?
I'm actually enjoying the conversation because it lets me know that you understand what the process is
right.
and some of the things that it takes to get a loan process. And Jackie, it really, like Steve said, depends on where you are when you come in the door. A lot of people are not ready to come in with an idea, and then we have a series of processes we have to send them through. Some people may think it takes longer, but the more prepared they are up front, the more apt that they are to succeed.
Alex?
Yeah, and just one final note, that there was a comment that I made during the retreat which was completely taken out of context and presented by the media and others in a way that was not intended.
which was in illustrating how much we actually have in the fund to loan, that somehow we were not being aggressive in promoting the program. And that was not the intent at all. And I think it's unfortunate that I created some jet wash through that that people got caught up in. I think it's worth noting that James, you've got a couple in the pipeline, don't you?
I do have a couple in the pipeline, and actually we have one coming Thursday night to make an initial presentation. Oftentimes you'll have people who have a good idea, they complete the application, but can't find the space. We need more retail space downtown, and this person's looking, but I told him to get him in the pipeline, come and present your idea to the Loan Review Board. It won't be complete until you find the actual space. So on Thursday night, we'll have a presentation from someone. And the other thing is, after that newspaper article, I got many inquiries. 90% of people were looking for grants, not loans. And I had to spend my time and explain to them about the loan program. So it was interesting that we got past that.
All right. James, do I understand correctly that criteria 9 to do with the job creation, that's tied to the original source of the funds through the CDBG right. grant? Is that right?
Let me get back to that.
$10,000 per job.
Oh, that's yeah. a criteria. So that we can, the main thrust of the fund is job creation. So we say for every $10,000 you get from the fund, we expect you to create at least one job. It can be full-time equivalents, because I know.
What I'm asking is, do we set those numbers, or are those somehow connected to CDBG?
Oh, no. We set that. The board set that when we set up the
okay.
fund.
And so if we wanted to, we could modify that.
You could.
Okay.
It seems like it might be worth considering, since the value of $10,000 changed a lot in the last 20 years.
But it was based on the CDBG criteria that was originally included, but since the money has rolled over, since all this has rolled over, we're no longer constrained by the by the feds.
Okay. Well,
but it's the basic structure.
One interesting question might be to look at in that regard. The CDBG program does have a standard for this issue
right.
of how many jobs or how many dollars per job. So maybe if you could inquire and find that number for us, just so we're aware of it.
Yeah,
I don't know what it is.
Been updated since
probably
1986.
Yeah.
But I must say that the loan applicants have always created more jobs than we required.
So it may not really be a problem.
Right. But,
okay. All right. Well, let's at least take a look at that. Maybe you can email the board if you could find that number for
us.
And I guess my final comment, I'm not sure I want to in favor of setting any specific target about what proportion of the money ought to be out at any particular time. But I do think kind of in that same general spirit that it would be good for us to, even if it's fairly briefly, to kind of articulate a plan of how we're going to how we're proceeding to publicize and make accessible that money, whether it be, and I think you've already mentioned a number of steps that are underway. It might be helpful to kind of specifically articulate what some of those are, and just think about whether there are any others that would be appropriate.
Okay. Yeah, which brings me to the other question I was wondering about is criteria 2 has to do with the size of the planned facility. And
what number 2?
Yeah. Does the planned facility is there any implication that could not be part of a home-based business?
It could be, but we haven't had anyone apply.
Okay. But if someone was expanding their home office and bringing in some equipment or whatever and hiring an assistant,
it could be used. Okay. Actually, I have someone inquiring about a beauty shop and a home right now.
Okay, right. Yeah, I remember that.
Okay, excellent.
Thanks, James.
Thank you.
I'm not interested.
No, I just want to be sure we did ask about, James, if you could get the payoff dates.
Sure.
Okay.
And I'll just email that to you.
Okay, that would be great.
Thanks, it's a great program.
Payoff dates,
some feedback about marketing the program and giving an estimate of the process time.
And then the other two things I recall are just what the current CDBG requirements are about the number of dollars per job, and then just if the staff would care to take a stab at possibly revising
the wording on financial needs.
11 or whatever.
I'll just offer as just a real quick caution. I certainly don't have any problem with trying to be more aggressive in marketing, but those have been around for a while. We'll remember that there are ebbs and flows in the balance, and there were some times where it got a little tight because we had a lot of money out and a lot of people coming in the door with good ideas, and so James and we had to be pickier. And, you know, I don't know if anybody actually got turned down, but we did have a backlog for a little bit, didn't we?
We did, and the way it works, you know, a lot of people have a lot of homework to do, and that's what takes some people a lot of time sometimes. They have homework to do because they don't have that business plan. They don't have those projections, and we need that information. And they drive how long it takes sometimes.
Mm. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks very much, James.
I move we accept the report.
It's seconded. Been moved and seconded for the resolution accepting the report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, manifest unanimously.
And I got a scream.
All right. Discussion of Leadership Advisory Committee final report. Does the staff have a presentation?
We do not. This is yours.
Well, let me, you don't mean mine, do you?
Collectively.
You are on the committee.
Let me just say, we had a very, I think, a very good and extensive discussion on the Leadership Advisory Committee with many, many different constituencies and interest groups that were there for the meeting. A lot of the discussion centered around transportation issues, as I'm sure many of you read in the press about housing, affordable housing, and market rate housing at Carolina North. And I guess the other key topic I would just mention off the top of my head is the what we call the footprint of Carolina North. How much of the site would remain open space, and how much of it would be developed, and I think the thing that's notable is that we got to a place in the discussion where I think there was a much greater level of understanding among throughout the committee about the interrelationship among all of those three different themes, that a compact Carolina North is going to be one that will be more accessible to, if done correctly at least, will be more accessible to public transportation, that will be more walkable, and that a Carolina North that includes a significant amount of housing will be one where automobiles and commuting will be less necessary because it'll be possible to be much more feasible to walk to work. James Carnahan is here tonight and has provided us with some comments. I hope everybody got a chance to take a look at that. Some of that. We don't ordinarily have public comment during our work sessions, but given the nature of this, if there's no objection from the board, I'd like to invite James to come up and comment for a minute if he'd care to.
And actually, for a change, I want to talk about housing last. I have a couple other areas that I think are very important that not enough has been said about. And I'd like to use the overhead if I could.
Only if you pay us. Soon to be budgeted.
Somebody can.
Only if you can do it without Drew's help.
That accessibility fee.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Drew's time to help you set it up, so we can recover the cost.
Okay. Generally, I think there's some really good principles that came out of this. And I think it's important to go ahead and mention some of those. The first general, and I'm going to be using, when I talk about anything, this bulleted format where I digested quite a bit of the language, and I pray that it's true to the sense of what we originally adopted. The first general principle, Carolina North to be a model of ecological, social, and economic sustainability. Serve as a template and guideline applicable for any community in North Carolina working to achieve a sustainable condition. This model will contain a variety of land uses found in a typical community. So, in addition to Carolina North being a place for great science to happen, new pharmacology and computing and so on, it also wants to be a model of sustainable land use. And then the second principle is that the quest for sustainable land use is a primary academic research and partnership mission at the university. So in other words, this study of and creation of sustainable land use is an academic activity and ideally will produce replicable guidance for other communities. The second area, in the area of environmental low-impact development and also consideration of neighbors, I think there's some good principles. And there was a concurrent process going on called the Infrastructure Work Group where they actually got into quite a bit of detail about especially low-impact development of the site and high energy standards for the buildings. The third area where I think we're generally happy with the outcome, the university committed to an additional school site that is in addition to the first school and committed at least to address daycare needs and also agreed that recreation facilities at Carolina North would also be for the benefit of the general community and generally committed to, in addition to public transportation, with trails and bikeways to make Carolina North not only internally accessible for pedestrians and bikers, but also accessible for the rest of us. And then finally, transportation. The default principle for transportation to, from, and within Carolina North is to rely on public transportation. Carolina North planning is to have the goal of modifying behavior so as to encourage the use of public transportation. But in the area of transportation, there's an interesting disconnect, which you can see in all of these. This is the center's plan of the three concept plans that was presented a couple of weeks ago by the university and was reported today, in fact, in the Herald that, that so far most of the comment had been favorable to this plan. And I would say parenthetically that the Village Project Board has already examined these plans, and we also like find much to like in centers. But when I went to the presentation, I ran into George Cianciolo, who is one of Chapel Hill's delegation, and he said, you know, it's interesting that we're getting these plans with these pretty clearly delineated transportation corridors, the red line. We don't know what the technology is, except we do know that this is the existing rail line, so there's obviously some use of that line. For George, interesting that we're already seeing this kind of detail about transportation when we have yet to complete the transit study that the towns and the university embarked on during the Leadership Advisory Committee process. And further, there is now, as you know, The visioning process that's the regional visioning process that has involved representatives from folks who are under Durham, Chapel Hill, Carborough MPO and Capital Area MPO. That process is due to wrap up in the fall, I think. But meanwhile, the university is proceeding and expects to show their Board of Trustees a fairly well, I assume, developed concept plan by July and bring it into Chapel Hill to begin the zoning and approvals process in October. And so that's one observation that I wanted to make. The next one is an area that the Leadership Advisory Committee didn't address directly, and that is the off-site impacts of Carolina North, and particularly more regional impacts, out-of-county impacts. It's a huge growth generator, 6 million square feet. It's a third of the size of RTP. And I asked Aaron Nelson once what he thought the secondary job creation would be, and he said perhaps three jobs for every job at Carolina North. So we're not just talking about 20,000 jobs or 25,000 jobs at Carolina North. We're actually talking about 80 to 100,000 jobs throughout the area. And to what extent will or even can planning at Carolina North address that? There's some reference to this notion, this area of concern, in the document, in the general principles, planning and execution of Carolina North shall be a model of cooperation for the mutual benefit of all stakeholders. Face the development to achieve sustainability and concurrent adequate public facilities. That doesn't necessarily just mean public facilities in Chapel Hill, Carborough, or even Orange County. Planning for Carolina North recognizes that it is part of a larger ecological, social, and economic community. Yes, the key. UNC will actively advocate for improvement in regional transportation. Address transportation impacts that will be experienced throughout Orange County and adjacent communities. That won't necessarily show in the plan, and so it's a question, I think, to be brought to the university, depending on the amount of detail in their transportation plan, which is how do folks who work at Carolina North, who don't even live in Orange County, how are they going to get there? Another aspect is the employment aspect. The one area where Carolina North could be some benefit and address a particular transportation and carbon emission issue that we have is employment. You've already heard the figure that 40% of Orange County employees go out of county for jobs. Another 40% come in to fill our jobs. The carbon reduction Cities for Climate Change draft inventory said that fully 52% of our emissions are transportation emissions. So it might be said that many of the jobs that will be at Carolina North are jobs that many people in our community are qualified for who are currently employees. And hypothetically, they would be qualified for the jobs that would be created at Carolina North. So a question might be posed, well, are they just going to accidentally come into these jobs, or would the university have a strategy which specifically addressed the fact that there may be a lot of folks already here who qualify for these jobs, and especially in recruiting the businesses in the early stages, that the university would somehow target their business recruiting to look for businesses for which our citizens, our residents would be qualified. And then finally, housing, about which I have said and written quite a bit already. And that was the one area where we didn't reach agreement. The university said we will build some housing, and they said that they would build a portion of that to be affordable to folks at the lower end of their pay scale. They wouldn't commit to a particular quantity, and they wouldn't necessarily commit to having the housing be built concurrently. In fact, they specifically said we reserve the right to build not much housing in the beginning and a lot of housing later on. The more housing at Carolina North, I think the less the transportation infrastructure Carolina North will require will cost and be the more housing that they build, the less impact they'll have on affordability in the area. There are some issues related to the amount of housing that they build, which are complicating factors. The more housing they build, the more we will have to deal with the need for schools on the one hand. And a second important area, Randy Kabrick, who's on the Chapel Hill Horace Williams Citizens Committee, pointed out that when they were looking at Carolina North, they were looking at the 6 million square feet plus 1,800 housing units, and they looked at Owosso projections and said, yeah, Owosso has the capacity for that. The larger numbers of housing that were speculated throughout the process has said, you know, that could be a challenge.
James, thanks a lot. Dan?
Yeah. I want to have a couple comments. First, I want to follow up on one of the points James made, which is a very important one, which is the question of the time frame regarding the transit study and the submittal of the application. And at our last meeting a couple weeks ago, the transit study steering committee or policy committee, whatever we're calling it, I posed that question directly to Jack Evans, who's the Carolina North czar or some such, and because the schedules were very clearly out of sync at that point. And he assured that committee that whatever the university is submitting to Chapel Hill in October will be in preliminary enough form that they will still be able to make modifications based on what we learned from the transit study, which should be completed a few months later, perhaps 2 or 3 months later. I do want to point out to everyone that the LAC was very helpful in kind of on working a roadblock that we got into over the transit study, and that Mark was very helpful in pushing that back at our June meeting and really getting us on course with that. So that was a good outcome of this, that in that case at least we had enough decision makers around the table that we were able to raise the issue and talk it through. Unfortunately, as James pointed out, we did not get there with the housing, and I would encourage everyone who's interested in this to look at the housing principles that the Carborough delegation put forward on the town's behalf that are on page 6, and basically with the principle that there should be dwelling units at Carolina North equal to the jobs created at Carolina North, not necessarily that everyone working in Carolina North would live there, but there would be the housing offset. And Mark, again, did some great research in terms of calculating the numbers that we're looking at, 93 green bridges of housing that would need to be built to accommodate just a conservative estimate of the number of employees there and not all the off-site impact employees that James was just referring to. So I think those are a couple important points to look at as people are reviewing this document. And there are a lot of excellent principles in here, as James said. I think it's worth reading and also looking for those areas of disagreement, because there are not a lot of punches pulled, even in this final report, in terms of where there's disagreement, and it kind of gives you a sense of what the local governing bodies were putting out and how the university was responding to that and where some of the tensions came up. And these are tensions that, where they were not resolved in this process, they're really going to play out in the Chapel Hill Council chambers over the next few years as the applications come in. As you can see from what they're thinking now, is what's coming into Carrboro under the current plan is a school site. And, you know, I think that's great for us. It's great for the whole Bowling Creek system. And we certainly got a sense, and the map seemed to indicate a sense of a strong commitment to preserving way up the slopes from Bowling Creek on both sides and all. And really, you know, they're wanting to focus the development around the airport site and closer to MLK and Estes. And, you know, so I don't think we're going to be having a lot of review of Carolina North in this chamber in the near future anyway.
You know, one comment I made, because I specifically did not participate on this because my father-in-law was the moderator, but I did watch it closely. And I guess I have some sort of questions. While the university is not agreeing to the housing commitments, have there been any overtures from either side to discuss that more fully?
We've had some pretty good, fairly congenial discussions with them, and I think to their credit, they've not ruled out the possibility of doing the kind of things that many of us were asking them for. They simply weren't willing to commit that they specifically were going to do it.
And in this process, are we going to follow up with more discussions, or are we going to lay low until they present that plan to the town of Chapel Hill in October?
I'm sure they'll do us the favor of presenting the plan to us as well, although it's not for our approval or disapproval. But actually, James has been working a little bit on that question of how we might. I don't know if you want to comment on that, but how we might continue the discussion.
I made contact with a group in Chapel Hill called Neighbors for Responsible Growth and proposed an idea of having a public forum, first of all, to review the principles from the Leadership Advisory Committee, because there hadn't been very much public documentation of that, and also to have an opportunity to compare these concepts as they come out with the principles, and generally to have provide an opportunity for the public to comment on Carolina North. And this event is tentatively scheduled for June 4th, Monday, June 4th. It will be in the Chapel Hill Council Chamber, I think beginning at 7:30 p.m., and several members of the Leadership Advisory Committee will be on a panel. As I said, the digest of the principles that I provided you is a first step in the work that we're doing to provide a little more detailed information for the public about the principles.
And after that, what is the next step? And the reason why I'm asking these questions, don't feel like I'm cross-examining you, James, because I'm not leading, but I think part of the issue, or some of the things that I would like to see, is continued discussion about the housing affordability issue. Because even if they don't concurrently build housing, there should be some sort of continued discussion with us, because while they may not be building on the Bowling Creek side of Carrboro, if you're going to add a school, you're going to add more pressure on the housing affordability, because people will flock to move here because of the school system. And we need to acknowledge that and determine what effect is that going to have on those other places in Carrboro. For example, redevelopment or more density. And what that effect's going to be, where the placement of the school is, because I can't tell on this side, and if you point it to me, I'd go, okay, fine, that's all right. But that's going to be a big effect. And if you don't think it's going to be a big effect, you do recall that about 2 weeks ago we voted on a moratorium and we had a developer get up and say, well, I just bought 30 acres across the street from the proposed new elementary school. And he wasn't doing it because he thought he wasn't going to make money. And so that's going to put a lot of pressure on our existing affordable stock.
Mm-hmm.
Dan.
I just want to respond to Joel's sort of more general questions. So I think there are really three broad areas of concern to Carrboro in this. Housing is definitely one of them. One is transportation. And we had a map at our last transit study meeting that I actually meant to bring with me and forgot where the consultant had drawn, like, just sort of big lines on a map showing where movement could be.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those lines goes from basically 54 West right across North Carrboro to Carolina North. You know where. There's
right.
no way to get there.
Right.
right. But, you know, those questions where a, you know, we're a full partner, not an equal partner, but we're a full partner and participant in the transit study, where those questions would be addressed. So, you know, our participation there will continue, and certainly through our participation in the transit system and in the transportation planning beyond that. The other area is the whole fiscal equity question, which is huge, and that conversation is ongoing, and Steve is our representative in that conversation, and perhaps, you know, we should get an update from Steve at some point on that. I think in terms of the housing, I think, Joel, you're absolutely right, and one thing that came out in the LAC is that Chapel Hill came into that discussion with a much lower goal for housing than Carrboro brought to the table. And I think the Chapel Hill delegation got that message and understood kind of the implications that we were laying out, much along the lines of what you're discussing. And I think that we're going to be in a good position to advocate with Chapel Hill as they review what's coming in, whether it's officially in front of their body or through, you know, member-to-member context and that sort of thing, and really try and push them to bolster up that part of it. So.
The only other thing that I would make mention, since the commissioners did approve the transfer station, is if you're going to have that size of development, what are you going to do with the trash? And if those trucks, there's going to be a transportation issue and a movement issue about the movement of that trash from that, you know, and it could be rail if that's what they're going to do. But I'm just, I'm cautioning you all to know that's an issue that has not been discussed. And it's not in the report.
You're absolutely right about that. And actually, we did have some brief discussion of that. I don't know if you all remember that, but it is an issue that our Carrboro delegation had some discussion about, and we never managed to get to that issue in our discussions with the university. But and we weren't looking at it in light of the county's decision to about where they were going to locate the transfer station, because we didn't know that at that time. But one of the interesting issues that's been out there for a long time in connection with the Orange Regional Landfill, and before that, dating back to the time when we were part owners of that landfill, is that although the towns of
Carrboro and Chapel Hill and the County of Orange have all kind of committed to cast their fates together on what we're going to do with our solid waste. The university, which is probably as big a generator as the entire town of Carrboro, I don't know if that's true, but on up there, on the same scale with town of Carrboro, has never been very specific about, or they've never been willing to make any commitment about what they're going to do with their solid waste. And so I think that issue is very much out there, not just the question of what they'll do with the waste that will be headed for landfill and whether it goes through that transfer station, but, you know, what level of participation they will continue to have in the future in kind of integrating themselves into our overall solid waste management plan for Orange County.
And I just say it's going to be an issue, and, you know.
Yeah. You're right.
The only other common thing I'd like to say is that, you know, we as municipalities are judged by how we treat people that are, and I put quote unquote what we consider to be less powerful politically. But the same thing will happen to us with Carolina North.
Mm-hmm.
So, I just, I'm done.
I want to remark on one more aspect of that map. James, could you point out on there where present day Estes Drive extension is? Do you know the answer to that question?
Yeah, Estes, as far as I know, stays
right.
Unchanged.
Mm-hmm. Under that plan, it's proposed to stay unchanged as far as what the alignment of it is. There was at one time a discussion about moving it.
Right.
They don't seem to be pursuing that now.
That was one of our principles we put out there.
Yeah,
was that we did not want to move. I don't have a theory here about this right now. But I just want to point out that Carolina North will have huge impacts on Estes Drive extension, and therefore on downtown Carrboro, and suburban Carrboro for that matter as well. And I think we need to be very aware of that and keep that as
one of the issues that we're looking at. This plan does that I liked about this one of the three was that this one, this particular plan, has a wider span east-west that seems to be that it's trying to integrate that rail, which is one of the things we talked quite a bit about. In terms of the potential for Carolina North. So hopefully the Carolina North folks, the university, have an eye towards greater use of rail.
Oh, absolutely.
Potential for rail.
The other thing that's sort of interesting looking at that map is clearly one of the things they're showing there is a new road connection that would be one of the main arteries for motor vehicles through Carolina North that would go from, if I'm reading it right, Sewell School Road there across over to connect to where I think that's Piney Mountain Road comes into to MLK.
Right.
I don't have a theory about what that would really mean, but I think that part, Sewell School Road, much of Sewell School Road is our responsibility, we need to keep our eye on that situation and be thinking about what the implication of that might be.
James, I want to thank you for coming behind and pulling out the bullets. I really think it was a great job. I think it was a long haul, and I think we really managed to do some pretty significant work. One of the things I wanted to point out in the LAC report that I thought was interesting is the UNC's offering for schools. They did offer one school, but clearly looking at the numbers, we know that more than one school will need to be generated, and I want to come behind that because I think that that's important. I think daycare is well-defined as something that will be taken care of, but other than one school, they really are not looking to build more schools. So,
and daycare is something that will be addressed.
It'll be addressed is the word they use. That's exactly right. Well, they did use that word. Yeah.
It will be a component of it.
And I just want to say, to keep a reminder, we are the only district that has an addition of students at the high school level.
Mm-hmm.
And the Carver High School was built, I believe, for $40 to $42 million. The elementary school cost $34 million.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, they haven't finished paying for it, I suppose. But we haven't finished paying for it. And so we need to take that into account when you're looking at the pressures of the county budget and human services. And so I don't know, was there a discussion about who was going to actually pay for the school or they were going to provide the school site?
Well, there was a lot of discussion about that issue. They said they would provide one site.
One site.
And that one site, the first school site, which is, James, you want
adjacent
to point
to
that, but up there adjacent to Sewell School Road, the only thing on the west side of Sewell School Road shown on that map, that not basically one site, not counting that. And in fact, in the universe, based on what Jack Evans tells me, in to the university's way of thinking, that is not, that first school site is not a part of Carolina North, and it will not be that sort of a fixed plan from their point of view.
Right.
And so as they're sort of working on their master plan for the rest of the Carolina North site, it is an assumption that the first school is happening there, and that the planners are not to mess around with that. And in fact, that the university is planning to bring that development application forward, not necessarily in connection with the rest of this discussion. So we may, you know, I don't know when. Actually, knowing the pace at which intergovernmental projects work, I suspect that we may see Carolina North before we see the first school, but the first school may be before us before the rest of the project is before the town of Chapel Hill.
The other project that's already underway is this business school related incubator that's going in south of Estes. That's in the Chapel Hill side, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But there,
I think it's
right.
That's been approved.
Right.
Yeah, been approved by the trustees, and they're looking for a partner. They're looking for, like, a public-private partnership in developing that incubator. So.
Right. So that's, likewise, not considered a part of the Carolina area.
Right. And I was just, you know, we know the cost of schools, and we know the attraction of the area to people to come to the school. And I'm just saying that that's something that there may need to be more discussion with, if there could be more of a shared funding stream. And it's all coming from the same place, really, if you think about it.
Well, and I think the other issue we raised with the university is that you know, we would like to get out of this more school sites, but there's no reason that they necessarily have to be at Carolina North. So
right. I mean, and I think there's an argument that they really don't need to be near Carolina North.
Right. They may make more sense elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Well, if the families are Carolina North,
it depends.
You can have a school.
Yeah, but you can walk across Carolina North to Sewell and Smith.
Well, and one of the other points, and Dan touched on it, and so did James, is the, you know, the secondary workforce that's going to come out of this. That's going to be huge, and so it may not be directly Carolina North employees or their families that, you know, need to be involved with the schools, but all the secondary workforce that will be coming with.
Well, we shall see. I'm planning on attending the June 4th meeting that James is putting together. That'll be most likely June 4th at 7:30 at Chapel Hill Town Hall. And I think we do need to think critically about how we'll kind of proceed beyond that point as a board to advocate for Carborough's interests in this process, as well as sort of regional, our entire region's interests in this project. Jackie.
I've been strangely silent through this conversation. Steve, in your work on the Finance Committee, I've read they're saying that they will have a negative, if not if not that they'll have a neutral, if not positive, impact on financing of schools. Have they committed to paying the school impact fee like every other developer has to, or are they wrangling that around?
We haven't gotten into those kinds of discussions yet. We're still working on developing the RFP to actually hire the consultant to do the study. So we're working on the scope of work right now.
So that's a while off.
That point is addressed in the LAC report, but I can't remember off the top of my head whether the university really agreed to it.
They said that they would abide by SAFO, I think.
Yeah.
But they made this kind of, you know, we will have a neutral if, you know, and hopefully positive impact on the funding from schools. They do not say we commit to paying the school impact fee. And I know I've been asking that question for over 5 years.
Well, so let me say this, that the school impact fees generate a relatively small percentage of the total cost of, I mean, in other words, $42 million high school, it's only like 10% of that comes from impact fees. But so in some ways, if they hold to what they said in the LAC report, it might actually be read to be a stronger commitment than that. But
so I should stop barking up that tree.
Well, I don't think so. But I think that's only one angle on the whole question.
And let me say, Laura Blackman, the Orange County manager, is also on the committee, and I'm sure she is going to be keenly interested in that particular subject.
Yeah, I think it is. Jackie, you're right, though. It's key that both the impact fee and the property tax payments for whether it's residences or for commercial businesses at Carolina North, that those payments are made directly just like for anyone else. That's sort of the foundation of how they're going to get there, because without that, there's all kinds of sleight of hand that can sound like it's revenue neutral or something, but that isn't actually meeting the needs that you're addressing.
And we'll end up subsidizing this.
Yes. How revenue neutral is revenue neutral?
Well,
is the question.
And you know,
and
you
what revenue is revenue?
Mm-hmm. Well, you also have to put in the context that, as a policy matter, the state of North Carolina is not, because of economic pressures and other pressures, is not funding the university's system. It's the same percentage as they did 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we have a parallel sort of fight for resources when the number of federal grants for research-type universities, which UNC is one of them, has decreased because we are spending a certain amount of money, you know, overseas, because the funding stream has been reduced. And you have to put that in context as well.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a longer than expected meeting, but I think it's been a really good discussion on this particular topic, and it's one that we need to have. I know the staff had, I think the Mr. Attorney, you had an item or two.
Two quick matters. One is that charter amendment dealing with special assessments is going to be considered tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock in the J2 or one of the committees, anyway, Berlinsko called and asked if someone could be there for that. And so either I or one of you can do that. And I think there's a memo that I did write to her at her office's request with the sort of bullet points as to why we're doing it, what it does. So either whether one of you need to commit to it or tell me to go to it, but somebody needs to be there at least to respond to her request. That's the first item. And the second item is even shorter, but let's do first one.
Joel, are you allowed to go?
I don't think it'd be appropriate for me to go. Although I'm in support of it. And my schedule won't allow it because I'm not going to be at work tomorrow. So.
I did my duty and went to the other charter amendment.
Maybe we could pay somebody to go.
You know, it's a couple $100 an hour, but okay.
It's up to you. I mean, she's asked, and can we go? I'll go.
Yeah, we just don't have anybody that can go.
Mike, well, okay. Well, right. I'm afraid we're going to ask you to go to that.
I'm going to really appreciate it.
Sure,
that's fine. Hopefully it'll be short and painless. The other item is even quicker. In order to construct the sewer line that we need to construct as part of the annexation process, we have to get the staff has had discussions with Duke Power. We have to get access to the area. The area is not owned by them, but get access through an easement that they own. So we have worked up an agreement, which I think maybe you got a copy of, and if you didn't, it's a pretty mild and innocuous temporary access agreement, which we just need you to authorize us to have the manager sign.
We don't have to pay for anything.
No, I don't believe there's certainly this, not in this case, and I TC Morgan's my office has been dealing with it, and I understand that.
So do we have a resolution before us on that?
I don't think there's a resolution, just your authorization to enter a temporary access agreement with Duke Power is all we need.
So
I don't know whether you have
passed. Second.
Okay.
By the way, Mark, do we need to approve the LAC report or not?
Not particularly.
Okay.
It's been moved and seconded that we authorize town manager to sign the proposed temporary access easement through Duke Power's property. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously.
Thank you,
Mr. Attorney. Board members,
can I just have a copy of a DVD or a... We do have a VCR, so I guess I could put that up. Just for the first portion of the meeting that I missed, and I apologize. I was still at work. We are a week away from people filing their lobbying reports, and we've gotten a lot of work to do, so.
Okay. I think it's simple enough. We can get you a copy of that.
Okay. I don't have to have the whole meeting. Just that.
You just want the...
It's probably easier to supply with the whole meeting, in fact. But
okay. Well, if that's the case, just supply me with the whole meeting, and I just won't watch the rest of it since I was here.
And it's riveting.
I know it is.
You can check out how you look.
I know how I look.
Mr. Manager, one quick item. I sent you all an email last week saying that because of some scheduling things, several items we had planned for the agenda next week won't be ready. Staff doesn't have any items for next week's agenda unless the board has something. We would suggest cancellation of next Tuesday's meeting.
Fantastic.
All those in favor of giving the manager a raise?
All right. So, it's a move to close it.
There's been a motion to cancel our meeting for next week.
Second.
All those it's been seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed.
There'll be plenty to do in May and June.
Yeah.
Right. 4-1.
Sometimes you can vote against something and still get what you really wanted. I've seen other people do that. I thought I'd love to try it once. So I got
all right,
to
well,
try
here's
it.
Your big opportunity. All right. With that, we are adjourned. Thanks very much.